Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 142 of Unblocking Crypto. Hal, as always, I keep thinking we're going to have a slowdown one of these weeks, but some big things just continue to roll in every week.
Definitely not a slow news week.
So I'm not even sure which piece of news to talk about, but one of the things that popped out to me was that crypto had its largest acquisition to date last week. So Stripe acquired a stablecoin platform called Bridge for $1.1 billion. And Bridge is a software platform that helps companies accept stablecoin payments, which is a big deal for a company like Stripe to be doing that and be focusing on the stablecoin space.
Yeah, you and I've talked about stablecoins, and it's almost like you got Bitcoin, crypto, and stablecoins, because the stablecoin adoption is a totally different mechanism to crypto, which is different than Bitcoin. And if you start to incorporate that stablecoins into the real world, I mean, Stripe's got to be one of the top couple of processors and payment processors. So if they start doing it, and you're not just the U.S., I think we're kind of U.S. centric, and it's like, yeah, we'll just use dollars, but get your head out of that and get into like global transactions and using stable coins instead of local currency. I think it's good that a $1 billion deal happened, because that might make the news in mainstream and get people paying attention a little bit more. Yeah, it's a good sign. You don't spend $1 billion without doing some due diligence and understanding the risks of the business. And so if they say, yeah, this is a good, we're going to spend $1 billion, you do that in hopes that you make several $1 billion over the next few years. And, kind of more proof that stablecoins have a real use case in the market.
Well, you and I have had some experience sending some international wire transfers before, and I've seen the average net right now is $44 to do one of those. I feel like ours were a lot more expensive, 2x or more expensive than that. But yeah. What's crazy now is on some of these L2s, sending these stablecoin payments, it's down to under a penny to send this, right? So it's amazing how cheap it can be, but not only that, how fast that's going to be too. I mean, it used to take us weeks for that thing to clear, and now it's clearing in minutes, if not seconds. So it is changing the world that we live in for sure, and it's definitely not being talked about, but it's probably 30%+ of all the transactions right now is stablecoin transactions.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about an area that's ripe for disruption, it's wire transfers. Like, you have to go in person to the bank. You have to kill an hour of your day at least, because just from driving there, waiting in line, going through the process. And yeah, I mean, when we were doing it was pre-COVID, so we're probably 50% cheaper than what it is now, because everything's just more expensive. Even if it doesn't make sense to be more expensive, like anything technology we're in, it should probably be cheaper. But yeah, I mean, we were $50 to $80 to transfer money to China. And if I could do that from my computer for a nickel, I will never go to the bank again. So, you'd start taking away a lot of that friction, a lot of those headaches. You got a real product. And so a lot of people don't interact that way, and they don't transfer payments that way. But a lot of companies do. And you do that one time, have one successful transaction where the guy on the other side is cool using Bridge and using stable coins. And I don't think you're going to go back to using wire transfers. And if you have a customer or a supplier on the other side that only does wire transfers, you're either going to use somebody else or you're going to talk them into using stable coins. So that, I think, you, in my head, I always think adoption is going to be faster than it is. But in this case, as soon as somebody uses it once, it's going to be so tough for them to go back. It's one of the most miserable transactions that you can make. It's worse than doing like a wire in the country where, like if you buy a house or something.
Yeah. Well, so I didn't want to lead with the SEC, but the SEC has been in the news quite a bit here lately, a lot too. We talked a couple of weeks ago about the SEC greenlighting some of the Bitcoin ETF options for NASDAQ. What just happened this past week is they did the same thing for the New York Stock Exchange and the CBOE. So it's I mean, that's exciting that they're, I guess, letting everybody into it. The unclear portion of this is there's still no idea when this is officially going to launch. So, I mean, yes, it's good, but it's also kind of a question mark. But at least it's kind of going down the right path, and the SEC is saying, oh yeah, Bitcoin ETF options, they're coming.
Yeah, I think we knew that there were going to be ETF options as soon as the ETFs were approved, and it's just a matter of time. I think that the options will bring a lot of funds into spot Bitcoin ETFs, because now you can hedge pretty easily in a package trade instead of hedging in two different separate trades. And that'll, like, hedge funds like to hedge, so that'll bring in a lot of money, and hedge funds have money. So I am bullish on options for the Bitcoin spot ETFs, and I am making sure that I have at least 100 shares of anything that I buy, because if we hit these choppy spots like we have been this year, selling covered calls is making money on Bitcoin when sitting and watching it. And then if Bitcoin does go on a run, then okay, well, I get liquidated, or I'm a forced seller at a huge profit. So I think I can live with that.
Yeah, covered calls might not be the solution for the next 12 to 18 months, but after that, I think absolutely for a while.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm not trying to make a 5% in a Bitcoin world where I think we could have 10% days, you know. Yeah. That's not what I'm trying to say. But this year would have been a great year to have options. We bounced around between 50 and 70 almost the whole daggum year.
Oh yeah. So speaking of driving a lot of money in, the ETFs in the US had over $2.1 billion of inflows last week. BlackRock was about half of that. They were probably about 3x the size of both Fidelity and ARK, which is crazy. I mean, this is like 30,000 Bitcoin in a week that was just bought up by the ETFs. And if you remember, I think there's about 450 Bitcoin per day being mined. So we talked about a supply shock, and there's a huge one coming if it isn't here already. And you're starting to see that with the price anyways, but it's also kind of crazy too. The ETFs crossed over the $20 billion of total flows, which is the inflows minus the outflows. And it took gold ETFs 5 years to hit that number. Bitcoin ETFs has done that, what, in 8 months?
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, you got 450 Bitcoin being mined every day, basically at, say, $60,000 of Bitcoin. So you're something like $30 million per day of new Bitcoin hitting the market. So you need a new inflow of $30 million a day to break even. And just these ETFs are bringing in hundreds of millions on big days. And so, you know, the supply squeeze that we talked about, you know, you don't really feel it until you're drinking out of a glass that doesn't have any water at the bottom, right? Like, yeah. If you everything's fine until you hit the bottom, and then the price has to go up in order to motivate sellers to jump into the market. And guys like me and you and everybody I know, we've all had enough time to add a little extra Bitcoin, more than we thought we wanted, more than we thought. And so it's like, all right, well, yeah, there's a price where I'm willing to sell a little bit of mine. And you can get there if you drive the price up high enough.
I don't know if I'll ever have more than I thought that I wanted, but
fair. But you know, everybody comes into Bitcoin. We're like, oh, I'm gonna get this amount, 0.1 yeah. Bitcoin, 0.5 Bitcoin, one whole Bitcoin. And then when you get there's nowhere to go but more Bitcoin.
Well, I mean, you look at those ETFs too. They have over $66 billion in assets under management, which is just under 4.9% of the entire market cap for Bitcoin. So, I mean, this is becoming just a huge thing for Bitcoin. We talked about MicroStrategy, how big they were, but they're just over 1% now, right? So the Bitcoin ETFs are just blowing by MicroStrategy and becoming this huge behemoth. And it's just getting started, right? I mean, I think the gold ETFs increased their inflows every year for 8 years. And we've had a record year this first year, and there's no reason why things won't improve in the next couple of years as all these investment managers actually get access to these two.
No, it's definitely still early days for the institutions to buy the spot Bitcoin ETFs. And I mean, well, Bitcoin at all, because it's the only way they're going to touch it. And, you know, right now we're 9 months deep. So over the next 6 months, we should start seeing some of the bigger guys allocate small positions. And then over the next 12 to 18 months, we should see those positions grow a little bit more as they get comfortable with it. And if Bitcoin does what everybody thinks it's going to do, which is, it's kind of funny because there's a lot of Bitcoin centric people are expecting this bull run, just like you and I are. You know, it's like, well, it's the 4 year cycle where, you know, everything's loosening up and there's a presidential election. And, you know, if either side wins, I think both of them learned this election cycle that they need to be neutral Bitcoin at worst, if not pro Bitcoin. So, you know, if the presidential election taught them that, then, you know, everybody underneath that in Senate and Congress elections are understanding it too. So you gain a lot in year four of the 4 year cycle from adoption, from moving the Overton window. So people are talking about Bitcoin like it's normal and no big deal. I mean, you got institutional investors talking about Bitcoin as an asset class. We didn't have that 1 year ago. And so, you know, put it on a bull run, send it to the moon, and then some of these institutional investors are going to redistribute and reallocate their portfolios so that they're not overweighted in Bitcoin and this and that. But then there's a ton of people like me and you and, you know, people that have been in Bitcoin for a long time that are like, this is what I thought was going to happen. And if Bitcoin becomes 50% of my net worth, then that's just, it's now 50%. I'm not going to sell my winners. And so it's funny to think about these institutional investors coming in later, piling in bigger sums of cash and really only being able to twist the arm of guys like us to sell small amounts of our Bitcoin stack at elevated prices.
Well, what's interesting too is, I mean, it's not just the Bitcoin ETFs that are starting to see a lot of action. You're seeing Grayscale filing to convert their large cap fund, the GDLC, which currently holds Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, Ripple, and Avalanche. So if this gets approved, and I think the chances of it getting approved with the current SEC administration is probably pretty low, but this would be the first combo crypto ETF ever, right? So that's exciting to see. And then even Canary, we talked about them a week or two ago, they just filed for a Litecoin ETF too. So there's a ton of interest, although I'm not really sure who's interested in a Litecoin ETF, but if apparently somebody is, because they're filing for it, or hoping that people will be interested in it. So, it's exciting to see for sure.
Yeah, I think a crypto ETF, like a heavily weighted Bitcoin, and then, you know, smaller allocations to other altcoins, would there be a place for that in the market? I mean, it would save a lot of people from having to do a lot of work trying to figure stuff out and have different wallets and create, you know, Coinbase accounts, or even if they're able to actually do it. So I would think that would have legs. I'd be curious. I'm curious to see what the SEC does there, because, you know, it seems as though the SEC likes to not approve things because what are you going to do about it? Right. Well, Grayscale is not afraid to throw a lawsuit at them and win, because the SEC is losing fairly frequently. So it'll be interesting to see if the SEC finally starts to play ball a little bit, or if they just maintain their same monolithic position that is block everything, slow everything down, go to the courts and lose.
Well, what's interesting is they've kind of doubled down against Binance. They had recently talked about the crypto token securities, I think it was, and Solana and Cardano and a few others being on that list. Well, they've pretty much said, they are saying that Solana and a few other tokens are securities, and they're kind of going after them there. And they have another lawsuit with Coinbase going on that they're still holding back files. And they were supposed to send these files like 20 days after they were requested. They keep coming up with new excuses. The latest excuse is they said they don't want to send anything due to ongoing investigations. And this is all started back in like July of 23. So it's almost a year and a quarter, year and a half kind of thing going on. But the SEC is always suing somebody. So they're going to just keep pushing this back, because it's going to take them years for any of these court cases to get finalized. So it's just kind of a mess. Like it doesn't seem like they want to get anything done. And everybody else is saying, come on, just give us some sort of clarity on what's going on. And they're not doing it at all, unfortunately.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the SEC binding things up in court for years is doing something. They think that's a level of success. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were kind of talking a little bit about this earlier, but what's crazy is all of this is going on, but if you were Googling Bitcoin on Google, the interest right now on that is at a 4-year low. So all this stuff is happening and nobody's paying attention, which is crazy to me, right? I mean, it's becoming one of the more exciting things to pay attention to, yet it's not even crossing anybody's radar.
No, I trust me, man. I was running through the things in my head because, you know, all year long, we've kind of talked about the fuel for the fire that's going to kind of ignite this thing in really starting now, right? I mean, if we can get to an all new high here, right? We just printed a higher high after printing a higher low on the charts, which is a good sign for kind of a turnaround in price. But all year it's been, okay, we've got the ETFs. Those things are just basically going to provide a buying pressure that pretty much doesn't stop. And, you know, in all of these dips and everything, the ETFs don't puke out a lot of Bitcoin. So it's really just sucking up supply. So now you have the institutional world is aware that the options are approved. So that's more bullish stuff. You know, this election uncertainty has got 2 more weeks. Hopefully in 2 weeks, we'll know who the president will be next year. That uncertainty goes away. You know, whether it's, you know, if the red team wins, I think you see a more short-term price increase because everything's bullish just based on what he talked about. He spoke at the Bitcoin conference and said some pretty decent stuff. He's got Vivek back there. He's got RFK Jr. back there. Elon's back there, even though he's not actively involved in crypto. At least he's got a company or two that's got some Bitcoin on the balance sheet, which is way ahead of anything else, right? Like for me to say that and like kind of he's in third place of the red team's transition team as far as Bitcoin goes, and he's got $500 million worth of Bitcoin on the balance sheet. But I mean, not only that, but you see like China's stimulus money's coming in. The U.S. cut rates, and it seems like the market's telling them maybe you cut them too soon, but still those rates are down. The ECB cut rates, like that's coming down. The minor capitulation's pretty much wrapped up. Like all of the stuff we've talked about all year is pretty much coming together in October. And so to think that there's anything other than, you know, blue skies ahead is hard to think of. But until that price, like I literally think, you know, until we hit 75,000, nobody pays attention. Like it's if you're not in Bitcoin, I guess you're just tired of hearing about it going up and you're just not paying attention to it anymore. Like it's just in the background. But like, you know, everybody was aware of Bitcoin at 10,000, 17,000 for sure. And we're talking about 70 and it's like no big deal. It's like everybody just adjusted to it. So for me, this I'm ready for this bull market to happen. It's kind of funny that I still think it is, you know, and normally I'm a counterpoint kind of guy and go the opposite way. But if we really do print our way through every recession, then I don't know why Bitcoin, you know, would collapse here. Like I could see the ups and downs and, you know, all that stuff, 50% drawdowns and things like that. But like a total collapse, it would be really bad. Like I think it would not just be bad for Bitcoin. It'd be bad across the board.
Yeah. Well, A16Z did a State of the Crypto report, which I do every year. And one of the interesting or a couple of the interesting things that I saw was one, the monthly active crypto users in September hit a new all-time high. So 226 million people in September, which has tripled since 2023, which is insane for it to triple, right? So right now it is outpacing internet adoption. So we're finally ahead of that curve, which kind of, I mean, from the late 90s to like early 2000s was a pretty exponential curve, and we're outpacing that. So we're not at the billion users yet. We're probably, a couple of years away at this pace. But yeah, that's exciting to see. And then even the infrastructure improvements, those have really increased capacity and decreased the cost. So you're seeing about 50x as many transactions per second as 4 years ago. So, I mean, things have definitely gotten better, and it's not something that anybody's talking about, unfortunately, right? So it's still crazy to me that all this stuff is happening and everybody's kind of brushing it off to the side still.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been a pretty consistent comparison of Bitcoin versus internet adoption. And you'll also see Bitcoin adoption versus cell phone adoption. And the whole time I've always thought, and I probably said it here, that the Bitcoin adoption should be faster because you don't have to buy hardware. You don't have to buy a computer and put it in a house that's never had a computer. You don't have to buy a cell phone and walk around with a cell phone in your pocket for a person that's never done that. You know, you really aren't changing habits very much to shift from spending, especially since everybody's already used to spending on Venmo and PayPal and all these different apps. Now it's just a different app on your phone. So I would anticipate that adoption would go faster at a certain point. You know, it's all like a tipping point and things like that. But not only that, when you talk about internet and a mobile phone adoption, you know, there's that initial capital cost restricts a lot of lower income people from jumping in early, where Bitcoin's barrier to entry is super low. I mean, in the United States, everybody's got a cell phone already. Now, a lot of countries, people have at least, what do they call it, a feature phone, where you can still operate with Bitcoin. And, you know, if you're in a country like that, you probably need stable coins at least, you know, and hopefully you have enough discretionary income to kind of put a little bit into Bitcoin or into a savings vehicle. So, yeah, I mean, the adoption should be fast and get faster, and it should outpace those previous technologies that required like a very significant shift in your day-to-day life. Whereas, you know, you don't have to remember to plug in and charge a phone every day when you're used to just having a phone attached to the wall your whole life. You know, with Bitcoin, it's like, oh, it's just another app on my phone and I just got to transfer money around.
Yeah, well, and Larry Fink, who we might as well just start calling the Bitcoin chief marketing officer.
Yeah.
He came out and said that Bitcoin right now reminds him of the early U.S. housing market. And so for those people that haven't paid much attention to the U.S. housing market, it's worth $50 trillion today at about a 3% appreciation. It's probably going to be worth $100 trillion by 2040. At $50 trillion for Bitcoin, that's just under $2.5 million a coin. At $100 trillion, you're talking about $5 million a coin. So that is a lot bigger than where we are right now. And Larry Fink is saying that's where he thinks it's going. So that's pretty exciting to see. And I'm hopeful it gets there, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I saw that. And I kind of tried to read through its transcript and understand what he was meaning. And I think that part of it was talking about like the emergent asset class of Bitcoin as compared to like the mortgage-backed securities asset class that grew out of the housing market. So I couldn't really tell if he meant like housing, because it's a long stretch to compare Bitcoin to houses to me. Like, you've got a digital value, you know, store of value, and you've got something you can live in and you know, is physical and requires being built. But if you compare it to the mortgage-backed securities, now it's kind of a derivative of the housing market. It's kind of a, you know, it's not a physical thing. So I'll be honest, I couldn't really figure out, because a lot of people were talking about the housing market. And I couldn't find, I found the transcript and I read through it. It wasn't super clear on what he really meant or what he really said, but give me $5 trillion, right? Like a $5 trillion market cap for Bitcoin's, you know, 4X from here. You know, you're into the 200s. Now that's you're in space, right? Like, you don't have gravity anymore. Everybody's looking at you and money's coming in bigger ways. So, you know, I always had this mentality going all the way back to 2018, 2017, that if Bitcoin could catch gold. That was my, like, if Bitcoin, it gets to the same size as the gold market cap, then I would consider that to be success. Because gold, you know, if Bitcoin's trying to be, if the Bitcoin thesis of digital gold and overcomes physical gold, that's, you know, stamp approved on it and see what happens next. Well, gold is on a run, like gold's market cap keeps shooting up. So, you know, my expectation of what Bitcoin can do keeps going up even more before it reaches what I consider to be like the first real threshold of success. I'm not a hyper Bitcoinization in my lifetime kind of guy. Like, I feel like that's going to take forever. But I think we could catch gold just on the store of value thesis, right? You know, investment thesis for institutions. And so I don't know where we're even at now. It's like gold hit like $2,700. So that's got to be something like 14 trillion. So, you know, what is that? $750,000, $800,000 of Bitcoin. So if you give me, what's that?
Gold's market cap is over 18 trillion right now.
18 trillion. So, I mean, that's really close to $1 million Bitcoin, depending on if you include the Satoshi coins and all the locked up and lost coins and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if my, you know, it was kind of fun to think about my first level of success being $500,000 Bitcoin when gold was 10 trillion. But if it's going to be 20 by the time you catch it, now you were into that $1 million Bitcoin, which I always thought was significantly further out in the future than catching gold at 500,000. But the last 4 years have been super weird, man. Like, it's really changed. It feels like we moved 10 or 15 years in two or three. And so, yeah, I mean, I still think that keeping the gold market cap as the first real goal for Bitcoin makes sense. Because it shouldn't be static. That goal has to move because they're printing money all the time, and everything ebbs and flows. So I'll still continue to do that. But then if I'm going to start to think I'm sounding crazy when I'm like, yeah, well, I'll feel pretty good about Bitcoin when it hits $1 million per Bitcoin. But $1 million Bitcoin today feels very different than $1 million Bitcoin in 2017. Like in 2017, $1 million Bitcoin seemed like you had to be crazy to think it could get there. You'd have to double the market cap of gold. Now, by the time we get to $1 million Bitcoin, we're still going to be under the market cap of gold because gold's going to be $4,000 an ounce.
Yeah. For me, I guess going back to the housing piece, it always comes back to Michael Saylor did a really good job of explaining where you wanted to put your money to have it last for a very long time. And Bitcoin seems to be one of the only places that doesn't have some sort of negative something fighting against it, like with houses, you're paying taxes and insurance on all those properties typically, which are fighting against the appreciation of the real estate. So, yeah, I mean, when or if Bitcoin ever gets to anywhere near what the real estate or the gold market is, that's just amazing if it gets close, right? I mean, I do think it will make sense at some point, especially with us continuing just to print money around the world, not just the US. So it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds over the next 4+ years at this point.
Yeah, I'll tell you, as a person who really kind of got into sound money, or at least understood how the dollar was falling apart through real estate investments, like, I have to get rid of these dollars and I need to get in something. And so that's what got me into real estate. Like, I fully understand how crappy it is to own real estate as an investment vehicle. Yeah, right now I have a house that's vacant. It's been vacant for months. I have no idea why it's vacant. It doesn't make sense. It's a good house. It hasn't rented. Can't get a tenant that qualifies or whatever. And you lose a month or two of vacancy to a house. Like, okay, well, your returns are shot for the year at least. And, you know, these are houses that I've purchased before COVID, or before the COVID ramp up in like late 2021. And so I'm still okay, but it still sucks. And, you know, that house, while it's sitting vacant, I got to pay the power bill. I got to pay in insurance and taxes have been insane and you have no control over them. You know, in order to sell it, it takes quite a bit of effort. And so I would say going back to 20, every time I sell a house, I buy some Bitcoin with it. And so in my mind, there's some other people are also doing this. Like, every time they liquidate some asset or some investment that they're in that goes into cash, some of that cash is going to go into Bitcoin. And the longer we go and the more people get into Bitcoin, the more money that is. But there has to be, I'm not the only one. And this will tie into one of the points I had, is the money market accounts are at a record high of $6.4 trillion. Right. And at 5% interest of what I would put in air quotes, risk-free return, you're getting 5% back on that money. Well, now we're getting 4.25%. And if you drop rates again, it'll be in the 3s. And as you do that, that yield gets less attractive. It's going to squeeze that money market cash back out into other investments. And yeah, I mean, a lot of it will go into the market and equities and things like that. Some of it's going to go into Bitcoin this time, and it'll be more than the previous time. And the next time we go through this wave and they raise rates and money market accounts go up, then when it gets squeezed, more money will go into Bitcoin. And so that's the kind of, you know, cadence that I feel like is favorable to Bitcoin. For, you know, guys like me, it's like, okay, I don't have to pay attention to the stocks, and as the CEO, you know, dating a Chinese spy like the Overstock CEO did, you know, like stuff that just tanks your investment because of some stupid human reason. Or on the house side, you know, I need a roof. They're okay, well, there goes 8 months of profit from the cash flows of the rents. And then, you know, yeah, you're building, you know, value in the property, but you have to sell it to capture that value. And then it's just way harder. It's so flipping easy to buy Bitcoin and sit on it and wait and just enjoy paying attention to Bitcoin and root for it and listen to the news and listen, you know, and understand the sound money principles and understand like how crappy it is that fiat currency and inflation screws everybody and makes everybody mad, makes everybody work their tails off all the time. You know, it's instead you can kind of shift gears, get out of dollars, get into other assets, and then you can kind of rise above the fray a little bit. And like, yeah, you're still using your time to convert into fiat money, but your savings is going up faster than inflation. And if you're doing that, now you do that long enough, and eventually the money that you can make with your time is less than the money that you make by beating inflation. And then you can start to think about, okay, well, I don't have to work as hard. On the flip side, if you just are in the US dollar, all you're thinking about is how many more dollars can I make with my time to break even? So this is the kind of why I think everybody talks about inflation really sucks for the lower income people, but that's it. They're going to run out of time. Like their skills can't improve fast enough to make more money per hour. So they work more hours. You can only work so many hours before you're maxed out. So, you know, not to get philosophical, but you know, that's kind of the way it works for me is you got to get ahead, but getting ahead is really hard. Like getting your head above water is really hard. But then once you get over it, it's better. But, you know, if people would start to understand Bitcoin is probably the fastest horse with the money that you can just sit on for 4 years and not touch, then even if it's a small amount, 4 years from now, it's a big amount. So, you know, you gotta put some money on the best bet.
No, I completely agree. So changing subjects a little bit to other concepts in crypto, one of which being gambling on election contracts. Polymarket apparently is showing Trump's odds of winning over 60% at this point. And the big question that everybody has is this being manipulated? Because the rest of the world calls it pretty much an even tie, right? So there's been a lot of stuff going on from that perspective. The founder of Kalshi, which is the alternative to Polymarket that is US-based only. So Polymarket's outside of the US. If you're a US citizen, you're theoretically not allowed to use it. What he has come out and said is that the median bet size on Harris winning is actually larger than on Trump. So it's like $85 to $58, and that more individuals are actually placing bet on Trump, right? So it's, I mean, which makes sense why the odds are 60-something% to 30-something%, right? So it's interesting to see that. What's also interesting is the CFTC attorneys have come out and said that the judge erred in allowing Kalshi to list these election contracts because it could be detrimental to the public, right? But it's crazy to me. It's like, okay, this is what the public believes. Why is this such a bad thing? You're just disappointed that you're not able to control the story and make up numbers and post them without actually having any real data. And this is probably the best real data you can have.
Yeah, I think there's some, I believe it's a law or something. You really can't have the election results in gambling markets in the United States. I think that there's a barrier there, and it's probably a good thing because, I mean, there's enough money on the line in elections already to create enough room to have some funny business despite the fact that the only unhackable technology in the world is the voting machines in the United States. There's still probably ways, if you had $1 billion on Kamala winning, and now that your odds are, you know, 1.5 to 1 or whatever it is, it's worth it for you to pull some strings and make something happen to sway the election. I mean, you know, you got 7 swing states, and each one of those you need between 10 and 50,000 votes to swing one way or the other. Like, if you're going to make $1.5 billion, you know, there's probably ways to pay people to get things done and make your $1.5 billion. So it gets a little tricky for me when you talk about gambling. I mean, you know, a lot of people, I kind of view, if you're lobbying and you're giving a candidate tens of millions of dollars and you're influencing them, you know, how different is that than placing a bet? Not totally different, but I don't know. The Trump numbers have kind of started running away. You know, he was down, you know, at maybe 46%. It seems like maybe 2 weeks ago, and he's gone basically at a 45 degree angle straight up and to the right to 60 something percent. That's a high chance of winning in a betting market. So I don't know. We'll see. I don't believe the polls. I think they're super flawed. I think the last couple of elections have proven that, even though they try to influence, you know, they skew the polls in order to balance the bias that they get in the population. But I don't know, you know, every election seems to kind of like make me shrug my shoulders and be like, okay, well, I guess this is what we're going to get for 4 years. Maybe everybody can just vote harder next time.
That's a whole nother topic to go down. So I did see something else that was, I'll call it interesting, a little frustrating too. Italy made the news. They are proposing to tax crypto at about 42%, which right now it's at 26%. The prime minister, I forget what her name is, but she had promised no broad tax hikes, yet she didn't do any broad ones. She just focused on the crypto sector and said, we're going to bump you up a little under 2x.
That stinks, man, because I think I liked her. I listened to her talk a little bit, or the translations of her talk a little bit. And I like what you had to say. A 42% crypto tax, 42% is a lot, man. Like, yeah, that's a big number for the government to collect for doing absolutely nothing, but probably standing in the way of your gains. I don't appreciate that very much. And it does also seems backwards. Like, are you really going, like, most governments heavily tax things they don't want people to involve themselves in. And taxes are in a big way a behavioral modification tool for the government. So if they don't want you to smoke, all right, well, we're going to quadruple the taxes on cigarettes. And guess what? Less people smoke. And the only people that really struggle are people that are addicted. And, you know, it's like a regressive tax, but it's, don't worry, it's the government and it's good for us to tax you this way. So other countries are going the other way and it seems to be working better. We talked plenty about El Salvador, but it's not just El Salvador. Japan's Democratic Party of the People, the leader of that, pledged to cut Bitcoin and crypto taxes down if he wins. So, but not only that, okay, don't pay attention to Japan. If you're in Italy, pay attention to the United States and look at what people like and look at what it's doing for Trump versus what it's doing for Kamala. I mean, it is not a difficult thing to see. This isn't just El Salvador, this is the United States, right? It's not as though the red team's getting a lot of popularity because of crypto, but the popular team, they're not paying any price whatsoever for being pro Bitcoin, right? They're only getting benefits. No one's so passionately anti-Bitcoin that it hurts them. And, you know, that includes the Elizabeth Warren shift in the John Deaton debate, where, you know, I've actually sat down and watched that for an hour, and it was astonishing to hear her kind of backtrack and back off her anti-crypto army statement. It was great to hear them actually press her on that. The moderators brought it up, but she really backed off. Oh, I'm not trying to kill crypto. I'm just trying to make it play by the same rules. I'm like, well, you actually predetermined questions with Jamie Dimon in a congressional hearing and planned on him saying, if it were up to me, I would kill the entire industry. And you're like, yeah, that's what, you know, well, I agree. So, and that was, it had to be a year ago. So, you know, when it comes time to get on the election campaign trail, now you're, oh, I'm not trying to kill it. I'm just trying to, you know, build some guidelines and safety rails Like, that's not at all what you were saying a year ago. So for Italy to go the opposite direction and crank up the taxes it's not smart. I mean, any of these older countries, like, they need innovation. So for them to go the opposite direction, I think it just seems like a bad decision.
Yeah, it's one of those that if that does happen, you're probably going to see what happened in every other country that tried to raise taxes on stuff that other countries weren't doing, and the good people were leaving. I mean, shoot, you look at the U.S. and it's the reason we have an exit tax. The U.S. raised taxes and people left and they said, okay, we're not allowing that to happen anymore. We're going to have taxes so high. So it wouldn't surprise me to have Italy implement an exit tax at some point here soon, just to say, well, if you stay here, you can't make all your money and then leave and then not pay taxes. So it's very frustrating. I was excited to see the John Deaton stuff. I think he had some great points in that. But what's interesting, Brian Armstrong, the CEO of Coinbase, has kind of come out and support him in a pretty big way. Elon Musk has approved Brian Armstrong's support of him. And there's a handful of other very pro-crypto people that have done that. But shoot, we talked about this, months ago, and he had maybe like a 5% chance of winning, something like that. Right now, the polls are showing like 56% to 34% that Warren's still winning, but he's making a huge comeback from all of that. And a lot of it is, there's a lot of people helping him for sure, but I think he's making some good points and everybody's realizing that Warren isn't who she really is anymore.
Well, it's the first time she's ever really had pressure. You know, she's a Massachusetts Democrat who's got a lot of authority. You know, states aren't going to give up. They're not going to elect another Democrat and erase the more years of seniority you have in Congress, the more power you wield. And so you're not going to lose. You're not going to do that to yourself. So, you know, for John Deaton to run and, you know, basically the only thing Elizabeth Warren has to say bad about him is, one, he's funded by crypto and he's going to scratch the back of crypto backers, which really doesn't mean much. I mean, I don't know what that doesn't seem very detrimental to me, because she's backed by people and she's going to scratch their backs and she's been doing that. So I don't understand why that's a problem. And then the other thing is she just attacks him on all these things. Like, he's a MAGA Republican and he constantly has to tell her, like, no, I'm the centrist candidate here. It's like, you're talking to the wrong guy. You're arguing a point that doesn't exist. You know, these are the things I stand for, and it's nothing like that. So it's pretty funny to kind of watch her have no idea how to play defense, because she just hasn't played defense in forever. So whatever. But if you're a politician, pay attention. Like, this guy is able to use crypto as a vehicle to go from 0% chance of winning to 5 to 10 to 34% a couple weeks before the election, like, against somebody who has a lockdown victory in that state. Like, he isn't going up against somebody who's in trouble. You know, he's going up against a real powerhouse.
I listened to a little bit of that discussion, and one of the things that's kind of stuck out at me was she kept saying, what's his ROI that he's getting from all the crypto bros? And I wanted to be like, what? So when you get money, there's an ROI expected. I was like, what is your ROI that you're getting from everybody? Like, can you tell us what you're doing for all these other people that are giving you money? And of course, that's not really coming up. We see it's a lot of the big banks that theoretically have been trying to kill crypto for a while, right? So yeah.
There's a reason why Jamie Dimon is in that congressional hearing and gets the questions beforehand. It's because JP Morgan is funding the bills for the election campaign. So to me, it's like, it's classic, like, politician nonsense where they're going to point the finger at somebody for doing something that sounds bad while they're doing that thing even worse. I'm so sick of it, but I don't believe in moral victories. I just think it sucks, but it has to shake things up for people to watch this guy really campaign and move on just the crypto platform. Like, if it wasn't for crypto, there's no reason that he would be campaigning against Elizabeth Warren. And he's having a outsized level of success compared to if he was campaigning on any other issue. So that matters. And so I give me that. And, you know, it's like Bitcoin stuff in general. Oh, well, El Salvador's going to make it legal tender in 2021. It's like, it doesn't mean a lot right now, but let's see what happens in 4, 5, 6 years. And so, you know, like we talked about Italy's crypto tax and exit taxes and stuff. And it, when El Salvador was given, was trading citizenship and passports for 3 Bitcoin investments in the country, I'm like, I probably should have bought a little house in El Salvador and got another passport. You know, that would be kind of a cool thing to have. So like if another cool country does it and has a deal like that, I may like spend and rebuy, spend and replace my Bitcoin and get another passport, because I don't know where everything's going anymore, man. It's crazy.
I'll send you the one that I've looked at for a little while that's a lot cheaper than El Salvador's. But so one of the other things that has caught my eye, and it's almost just frustrating to even talk about this. So Craig Wright is back in the news. If you remember, Craig Wright sued because he thought, or he was telling everybody he was Satoshi Nakamoto and all yada, yada, yada. And the court proved that he was full of it and he was lying, yada, yada, all that good stuff. Well, he sued Bitcoin again. He has this time sued the Bitcoin developers and said that they deviated from Satoshi's original vision with their SegWit and their Taproot upgrades. So BSV, which is Bitcoin Satoshi's Vision, which was kind of the first fork back in 2017 when the SegWit upgrade came, that fork really fixed a lot of the bugs and increased some network efficiency. He is saying that he wants to be paid the difference between the market cap of BSV and the market cap of Bitcoin, because BSV deserves the Bitcoin name, not they shouldn't be Bitcoin Satoshi's Vision anymore. So he's suing for like $1.18 billion. I think BSV is what, $65? And Coin, I think at the time, was like $62,000. So this is just super frustrating. I mean, if you look at Taproot, that happened in 2021. And that's when Bitcoin Cash was created. And really the big difference between that hard fork was just some improved privacy and data efficiency, and then also reducing the transaction costs. So this is kind of open source code that everybody agrees on and they move forward with it. It's not like, okay, one person making a decision and moving forward. So it's just even frustrating that people like this can even bring this up and go to court for it when I feel like they have no leg to stand on.
Yeah, I guess the only thing that I like about it is he's already been pretty much smashed in previous rulings. And so future court rulings will take that into account. And at a certain point, he'll become a nuisance. The judges will realize that, and it'll be quicker to get dismissed. So I don't know. He's just a problem. So it's not going to ruin Bitcoin. It's just annoying.
Yeah. Mt. Gox was also here recently in the news. I don't know if we talked about this a while ago or not, but they have pushed their repayment schedule back to October of 2025. They still have about 45,000 Bitcoin left to pay, which is just over $2.8 billion, but they're having a problem finding certain people. So instead of having it end this month, they are pushing it out a year to try to find those people and get that Bitcoin back into their hands.
If I had Bitcoin in Mt. Gox, it would not be hard for them to find me. Unless I was dead, I'd be like, I'm right here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's probably my thought. I mean, this is what, 10 years ago at this point? So
yeah,
what percentage of those people aren't living anymore? And is that why they're having a hard time finding them? And I guess you're trying to figure out if they had some sort of will or trust and where it goes to that point. But I don't know. It's frustrating. I mean, it did create a lot of FUD for a little while in the Bitcoin community of when this money was going to come, or when this Bitcoin was going to come back to people and if they were going to sell. Now, I guess that's being pushed out a little bit. And I mean, it's still almost $3 billion, which in the grand scheme of things is not going to be much sell pressure, considering we're having weeks in the ETFs that will gobble that up.
Right? Yeah. So you push it off till next year. That's fine. The Mt. Gox thing gets smaller and smaller the further we, you know, keep going forward. And, you know, for me, the 200-week moving average is up to $40,000 of Bitcoin. that 200 week moving average is typically a good floor. Like we bounce off of it in even the worst of times, in the lowest drawdowns. And so 40,000 being a fairly reliable floor, $3 billion coming from Mt. Gox isn't going to drive us down below that. So if your overall cost basis is less than $40,000 in Bitcoin, then you got to feel pretty good about yourself as far as what you've been able to do right now. When this Mt. Gox stuff, the Craig Wright stuff, the government stuff, the whatever stuff, it shouldn't even affect you at all if your cost basis is under 40.
The other news that I saw, Kraken came out with their KBTC, which is their version of wrapped BTC. So BitGo had originally done the wrapped BTC, and actually Coinbase and I think 21Co also have their own version of wrapped Bitcoins. So they just came out with it to create another alternative since everybody's questioning wrapped BTC, and they are using the Ethereum network to put it on. So that's kind of interesting as well. And of course, showing all of their assets or all of the assets for that in proof of reserves and all that kind of good stuff. So exciting to see there's other options coming out there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what I think about wrapped Bitcoin, to be honest. I'm aware of it, but you know, if it's something that you can bounce out of and do cheaper transactions and then bounce back into real Bitcoin, maybe that makes sense to me. I don't know why you would want wrapped Bitcoin if you're already into crypto. To get Bitcoin would be better, but honestly, if they have proof of reserves, which if you have wrapped Bitcoin and you don't have proof of reserves, it just seems like a scam, because you should easily be able to prove your reserves just by making your addresses public. So if they're doing that, then guess what? They're another consumer of Bitcoin, and that's good for the Bitcoin network. So you can't stop people from using it the way they want to use it. That's the beauty of it. So even if you don't like it, too bad. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't work, it's not the end of the world. Bitcoin doesn't care.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, having the wrapped Bitcoin gives you the option to get into the DeFi ecosystem a lot easier, which I know we don't talk too much about that, but that's definitely continuing to grow as well. So makes it easier if you're in Bitcoin already. But I mean, yeah, I agree. I think Bitcoin is the safe place to be for the most part. I think where you and I disagree sometimes is that I think there are other tokens and chains out there that are going to do very well too. And that gives you the ability to get into some of those or to do some of those things too.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You know, until they build the DeFi stuff on Bitcoin directly, then it kind of creates the Bitcoin DeFi sandbox in wrapped Bitcoin. I don't think that Bitcoin is the only thing that will ever come out of crypto. I think that there's too many use cases and opportunities, and people will figure it out, and there's too many smart people trying. But I do think when it comes to the money side, it's going to be tough to beat Bitcoin unless it's like an internal blockchain token kind of thing, like XRP, right? Like I could see how banks would be like, hey, we're going to use XRP and we're going to roll it out internally. And then if the big four banks do it, well, now XRP, every bank's going to have to do it in order to be on the same network and talk.
Yeah.
So coin XYZ, you know, could have a use case, and that's not a good one for Bitcoin. Granted, it's essentially what Strike does for people, which is, you know, transferring that value from one place to another in quickly, cheaply, and with some confidence. But, you know, if you're a bank and you'd rather sign up with a company that you can call somebody and yell at them if something goes wrong and undo a transaction or whatever, because you're not on the Bitcoin standard. You're moving US dollars around and you're trying to make profit on the transfer. So no, we're not that far apart, but I need to either do more research and figure this stuff out, or not do any research and just like go like play golf and go outside and hang out and just wait for Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with just staying in Bitcoin and doing nothing else. I mean, I think the deep end space and the gaming space, there's going to be a lot of stuff that happens there that crypto is enabling. I mean, just look at the last game that came out and jumped to number one on the Epic Game Store in like less than a week, right? So that was all blockchain based. Now it's not perfect, but it's definitely going down the right path.
Yeah, I mean, I will say I'm surprised that gaming hasn't picked up even more. I'm surprised that I'm not like feeling like, oh man, you know what? I'll try that game, that popular game that's tied to crypto. Like, I'm kind of old, but I'm not so old that I'm unaware of mobile games and popular stuff. I've got a 12-year-old kid. Like, he has never been like, hey, can I download this game? It's, you know, it's crypto, da 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 da. Like zero of those. And I get the requests for app downloads pretty often, and none of them are crypto oriented. So that it seems like that's taking a lot longer than it should.
Yep. No, definitely. So the other space that we don't talk a lot of is meme coins. And not that this is officially a meme coin, but it almost seems like it's acting as if one. World Liberty launched last week.
That's right.
Donald Trump's financial, whatever you want to call it, coin. It had like $1.5 billion valuation. They were trying to raise $300 million. You had to be an accredited investor to buy it. They sold about 12.8 million out of the 300 million they were expecting to. So it has been kind of a huge flop so far. And I think everybody's kind of joking that this is really more of a meme coin than it is a utility. I'm not sure what's going to happen with it. It's still very questionable with the people that are involved. And I'm not talking about Trump. I'm talking about the people that were kind of creating this from the background perspective. So yeah, it didn't go well. I'm not sure if that'll change, but that is definitely something I was kind of keeping my eye on to see if there was anybody really willing to fork over money for some of those tokens.
Yeah, I'm not paying a lot of attention to that, but it did cross my radar that they were very underfunded when they released. It seems like if you look at the Bitcoin dominance chart, like Bitcoin dominance is rising in a pretty big way, considering there's a gazillion other coins out there. So it's almost like the more crap there is in the system, the more people just say, screw it, I'm just getting Bitcoin. And that's going to hurt all these little projects all the way down. And so I think that's fine. The more people see like a high profile, you know, if this was overfunded and everybody's clamoring for it and it's got 300 million in a waiting list, well, if you've got Mark Cuban coin and every other billionaire trying to do it, well, now you're just playing all these dumb games again. So I'm fine with a failure in that at that level, because the sooner we start to differentiate between Bitcoin and crypto in the masses, right? You and I make a point to say Bitcoin and crypto as two separate things, because it very much feels like everything, even stablecoins being a third piece. So I think the more people can understand that quickly, as opposed to, I mean, it took me years before I kind of differentiated Bitcoin from the rest of crypto. Now we were in a different world then. Now it's a little easier to see the difference in. Even, you know, the ETFs kind of explain the difference for you too. But yeah, I think it's probably good for some of these things to get launched and not do well. I would like to see less launches of new stuff, like especially things that I don't know that we even need.
So you mentioned Strike earlier. One of the easiest ways, I think, to buy Bitcoin out there. Venmo has just announced they're planning to use MoonPay to allow customers to buy Bitcoin and Ethereum, which is kind of a pretty big deal. Venmo has 60 million users in the US, although I think those in New York and Texas are not going to be allowed to do this, but it does give people the option to buy and sell Bitcoin and Ethereum. I think MetaMask and a few others have already enabled MoonPay for their customers to do this. So, I mean, it's just another big step forward and makes it easier for people to get onboarded into crypto in general, because I think you can even buy with a credit card with MoonPay too.
Yeah. I mean, like we just said it when PayPal launched and all these other things, it's like the more spigots you can open up to get funds to flow into Bitcoin. One, it sounds selfish because it's like, yeah, I want Bitcoin price to go up because I own a lot of Bitcoin and I believe in it. But two, more people are able to get to it. And it like, I guess I sold some furniture out of a rental house and was paid in, I guess it was paid in Bitcoin, or it was paid in US dollars in PayPal, and I instantly flipped it into Bitcoin because I'm like, you know, it's kind of funny money. You know, it's like just something kind of just fell in my lap and selling some furniture. It's not like a planned money. So if people start doing that, like if you're, you know, there's a ton of people that make little side gig money on selling stuff online and, you know, flipping furniture or whatever. And if you start moving that into Bitcoin instead of keeping it in the dollars, well, your little fun money stash kind of grows, and you can learn a lot from that in, when it comes to your real money stash. So like, it's very difficult to convince me that something is bad for Bitcoin.
Last thing that I had on my end that was pretty interesting, MetaMask and Space ID have partnered with a goal to simplify crypto. And I think we've always said that the user interface for crypto, while it's gotten a lot better, it's still pretty difficult. You don't have to take the picture of yourself holding a little sheet of paper with your ID and having a date on it and all that kind of stuff anymore. But the goal here for these two companies is to create like a single address that allows you, and I say single address, it could be a almost an email address or something like a Venmo username that is compatible for all EVM chains, right? So for me or you to be able to send crypto back and forth, we could use that address instead of the 30 something hexadecimal address that Ethereum uses, right? So it would make things a lot easier, and making sure you don't mess up that one digit that could screw everything else up and lose your crypto forever type thing.
Well, even if you copy and paste the giant wallet address, it's nerve-wracking because you're like, you look at it, and I usually check the first couple of digits and the last couple of digits just to make sure I didn't kind of lop one off or something. But like, it's nerve-wracking to be like, oh, well, I hope all the ones in the middle are right because I'm sending this thing full go. So I think if you could get to a point where it's a little bit easier and you just say at unblockingcryptopodcast.eth or .whatever, and you can verify it just like you do with Venmo, I think that would be a lot better. You know, it's kind of the same thing with QR codes. They kind of simplify that. Like, I would trust snapping a picture of a QR code and getting a verification of somebody's name or picture or avatar or whatever than copying and pasting a 32-digit hexadecimal code. Like, I don't know why, but it makes more sense. It's like one of them feels like I'm outsourcing the responsibility of getting it right to the QR code, and the other one is more on me to copy and paste it correctly.
Well, and it's also, to me, it's one of those things where if you're doing this for all EVM compatible chains, I don't know how much you use MetaMask, but there's a bunch of different chains that you can change. So if you send, say, BNB to your Ethernet address, if you don't go to that BNB chain, you don't actually see it in there, right? So hopefully what I'm expecting them to do is have a very simple portal that says, here's all of your assets in one easy to understand portal, and you can move it around or do whatever you need to do by looking at it simply. So that, I mean, there are companies that have kind of like what we just talked about, .eth addresses and things like that, that do something similar already. It's almost more not just creating a portal to do this, but getting other people to accept the ability to send those addresses to that as well, right? So not everybody accepts .eth addresses right now. I don't know what this one's going to be, but hopefully it'll be something similar that people will take and utilize fairly quickly rather than taking years or decades to roll out.
Yep. Yeah, that's... we'll see. I mean, it seems like a good idea. I mean, like we talk about it pretty often. I mean, the user friendliness of using crypto and Bitcoin is probably one of the biggest barriers to adoption because it just feels so funky.
Anything else that we missed?
Yeah. So I did a poor job of transitioning while we talked about politics at the beginning of this podcast and mentioning this one, especially since we talked about Italy. And I didn't bring up that the ECB came out with a publication that caught my radar because poor Demeester, who is a crypto Bitcoin and analyst pretty well educated, he said it's the most aggressive paper from an authority that he's read to date. Basically, it said that Bitcoin is bad and didn't really hang its hat on the environmental side. It said it's bad because early adopters win at the expense of late adopters, which is a terrible argument against anything innovative. Like, I think if the same could be said for investing in businesses early and or creating your own business or almost anything that's on a growth curve, if that's a reason to say something is bad, then we're stuck with everything that we have the way it is. And so, you know, you get paid for the risk by investing in something early. And if it works out, great. If it does not work out, you don't get bailed out. You just lose your money. And so I think that that argument was dumb. They also said that Bitcoin is divisive, which is odd because I feel like if somebody's got wildly different beliefs and opinions from me, or lives in a different geographic country, or has a different ethnicity or religion, and we talk about Bitcoin, we have a lot in common. So I don't follow the Bitcoin is divisive theory at all. And then finally, they said it provides no economic value, and they're people that print money for a living. So they would have negative economic value. And I think that that's garbage, especially if you talk to Texas's power grid. I would say that there's a lot of value there. It supports renewable energy in a pretty major way, as well as nuclear. So that's a pretty major economic value. The disrupting cross-border payments is massively useful and beneficial for everybody on both sides of the transaction. It's not useful for Western Union, but you know, digital cameras weren't useful for Kodak either. You didn't say they were bad. So I don't understand any of their arguments. I think they're all misguided at best. And I think that this just disappears and gets made fun of. And 5 years from now, we look back at it like this is the dumbest thing that could have been written based on, you know, kind of where we go. So I think that was worth mentioning just because it's central banks pushing back on Bitcoin is going to be a thing we see a lot. And if this is what they're putting together as an argument, since the environmental argument has faded away in a major way, then they're really running low on arguments against Bitcoin.
Yeah, if you look at what France's central bank has done to all the countries in Africa that it owns, every time they get involved in any country and force their influence on them, they've actually been going backwards. Compared to everything else. So what Bitcoin enables is a way to get out from underneath the pressure of one of these major central banks. And I haven't really heard of anybody saying anything bad after when that happens, right? I mean, shoot, we looked at Bhutan and they could become one of the biggest players in the world because they decided to go all in on Bitcoin and they're mining it using their hydroelectric power and everything, right? So it'll be interesting to see if in a decade from now, they're one of the top 20 countries in the world in terms of influence.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because like Bhutan's like small country and everything else. And you would think that energy intensive countries would have a huge advantage when it comes to Bitcoin because they could mine using power. And so my mind goes straight to the Middle East. Bhutan is using hydroelectric power to do this. Like, you know, so it's Bitcoin does a good job of like bending what you think is, you know, the avenue for people to do things, because they're really smart people out there figuring out ways to get things done. And they have a different view on things and they have different resources available to them. And I mean, they didn't tell anybody for years that they're doing it. Like, that's a pretty solid move. And, you know, it's fine with me that the news breaks right before a bull run and maybe some countries are starting to get interested in it. And, you know, it's like, oh, by the way, I can't remember what they have. Like, it's close to like 5,000 Bitcoin, I think. Like, yeah, they're doing pretty good. And, you know, you could have done it too. And also, not too late. Like, you're not going to be the first country and maybe not the second or third, but you know, you're still going to be in the top 10%. That's not bad.
You're running out of time, though. That's for sure. I mean, Germany made it easier for somebody else to jump in there in the top five for sure, which I think they're even talking about buying some more Bitcoin back after having a conversation with Samson Mao, but we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. So I did, it came across my radar that there was at least one, I don't know if it's a parliament member or however, there was one female Bitcoiner or at least Bitcoin sympathizer that was like raising her hand like, hey, we shouldn't do this. So there was a little bit of a dissenting voice. And I mean, that's all Bitcoin needs is like one out of 50, one out of 100. And then it becomes two and then it's four and then it's eight. Like I think people still don't realize that that's how this works. Like the one voice out of 50 is correct. And 2 years later, Now, the 49 other people didn't listen, but one or two of them did. So now it's three on 47. And, you know, it just grows pretty quick. Next thing you know, it's 26, 24 pro Bitcoin. And then you're off to the races. And we're just, you know, we're still in that slow growth period. But I think if we get the bull run that we think we're going to get, I think we hit a pretty steep curve here. There's just so many people have heard of Bitcoin so many times that it becomes like, okay, maybe I'm into it now.
Yeah, so we have kind of blown over our estimated time that we usually take, partly because this is just another boring week in crypto.
Nothing happens. Slow week.
So we'll see what happens next week and if it's boring again.
Sounds good, buddy.
All right. Thanks, Al.
Thank you.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.